File identification. This is an interview with Ken Sadler on the 20th of January 2016 for the Upper Hutt in the 1960s Oral History Project. The interviewer is Karen Wilton, and we're at the Sadler's house in Masterton using a Zoom H4N recorder with AKG C417PP clip-on mics. This is file two.
Hi.
So, Ken, I was just going to ask you about, it was kind of a boom time in Upper Hutt, wasn't it?
It was in a way, yes. Upper Hutt was a boom, yes, because it was growing, so therefore the town or the shopping centre grew with it. And where we had little shops, corner store, it's now got into the main road development, and then we actually saw it like the beginning of a supermarket. It was the Mall, the Maidstone Mall, and that was opened up, and we thought this was marvellous, but they didn't quite manage to fill it with stores, I don't think, but it was still a very popular place. But then, of course, it came to a stage just about the time we were leaving Marston to come to the Wairarapa. It started slowing up a little bit, and things got a bit down. The mall got less popular, and so it went on. And it, certainly they got to a very low ebb. But our time Upper Hutt then was actually, we'd left it and gone, you know. But it was hard to understand it sort of dying like that.
Was there quite an optimistic kind of a feeling in the 60s?
Optimistic, I think so, yes. It was, people weren't down in the mouth. We talk of poverty today. We never saw anything like that. We saw poor people, you know. But you wouldn't say it was poverty. They still had money in their pocket. They could still get their kids to school and so forth. But some had more than others. That was true. But it's certainly there was no divisions or anything like that. There wasn't an area of poverty-stricken people and others sailing high, as it were. There was one or two areas where the more elite would collect, and I'm trying to think of the name of the street in Eritonga. There's a grove down there. Jean?
Yes.
What was the name where Selwyn Toogood used to live? And Norm and
it was Trenton, wasn't it?
But the name of the street.
I've been down that street, I think. Yes. Huge trees. And
that's
things,
right, lovely.
Yeah.
Where Norman Uniacke was.
Yes, I know, I've not been
there. Oh dear, it's just by the lights at Eritonga there.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
It's a U shape.
Yeah.
That was really something. It's now, you and I are living down there now, I suppose. But at one stage, it was managing directors and high class business people. And I always remember Selwyn Toogood being there too. But so there were areas like that, but they were very small. The majority of Upper Hutt were working class people. When I say working, I don't mean naturally manual. They could all be office of all sorts, but they were Monday to Friday people. I don't think there was much unemployed, not that I can recall in those days. And so thinking of all our children's friends and their friends' friends and so forth, they were all employed, and some had little shops going and so forth, but some of them lived humble lives, but they had what they wanted and what they needed.
And there were some pretty big employers in Upper Hutt too, weren't there?
There was a lot of employment there, yes, that's true.
The big factories, Dunlops or General Motors?
I was just going to say Dunlops, and they were running 24 hours too. And, the golf club, because they did belong to the golf club there, that's true. Team Rua, and I took up golf later in life. I should have taken it up a lot earlier, I think, but I took it up later. And I used to play at I played there until just before we moved to come to the Wairarapa, when I was so busy, literally. I had a new job with Mobil, which had me going, literally 7 days a week. I mean, I was still working when I was home. And Jean was sort of saying, look, you know, you should really find something else to try and relax yourself with. You can't, but you haven't got time for golf, that's for sure, because you're giving up half a day or even three quarters of a day. So she said, well, why don't you give that up and take it up, you know, a bit later on when you've got that maybe when you retire. So that's what I did. I didn't take it up again until we moved to Terenika. But maybe the golf, that was another thing that kept us very involved. So, I mean, they have their social functions as well as their tournaments and so on. I'd forgotten about that side of it. So another ring of friends. Although I had not, certainly introduced me to new friends, a lot of my mobile mates used to play at Upper Hutt too. Although they worked in Wellington or lived in Wellington or out of the suburbs of Wellington, they were Heratonga members, you see. So we would play on a Sunday morning, you see, meet a team then.
So you had quite a sociable time, really, didn't you?
Yes. Oh, very much so, yes. And the functions that I used to have to organise away, these management educational sessions, where I literally take over half a hotel, as it were, and to run these educational sessions. Well, they worked hard. I used to work them hard till 10 o'clock at night, I suppose. So every now and then, third night or fourth night, it'll be a night off. And it was a social night. And I mean, not a boozy night, I don't mean that so much, but it'd be a real social night. They'd go and do something, have some fun. And of course, when they wound up the last, right at the end, it would be a social function.
Now, I was just thinking again about the parade for the city celebrations, the civic celebrations, because your son made something for the parade.
Did he make something? Oh, the quad cycle?
Yeah.
I think, oh, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Pardon?
Can you tell me that story?
Yes. He, with a friend of his, Johnny Hayes, they used to get up to a lot of things, making this and making the other and so forth. And they managed to get two old ladies' bicycles. And they just, looking at this, they thought they'd try and join them together somehow, you see. So they both had crank, only one steered, but they had all the cranks all operated. So you need the two people were cranking it along, but one steered and so forth. But the two bikes were joined together. And they were coming up to the Upper Hutt celebration when they thought, well, we could make this into a little car. So they got a lot of help from John, from his dad, and Paul, from me, I suppose. We sort of helped them think it out. But they literally did it. You know, they did all the manual side and put it together. And they built this thing and they carved it. So it looked like a little when they finished, it's like a little two-seater car with a dickie. You know, remember the old dickies on the back, you see?
And no, I don't. What's a dickie?
Oh, well, it's a two-seater car, but the back had instead of a boot, it could lift. Well, it was a boot, but that would lift up and had seats inside it, and you could sit in there.
Yeah.
Well, this had the boot on it. It didn't have the seats on it, but it had the back on it, boot. And it had the windscreen, and they made the collapsible hood to at the top. You know, that was. We got the material and what have you for them, and I did. I must admit, I think I got a professional to cut it and shape it for them, but they actually fitted it and got the thing on. They painted it and so on, and we had number plates made for it. I think they had the year of the Upper Hutt was formed. Formed, that's right. And I forget. Yes, it's Upper Hutt, UH, and then the year. That was the number plate either end. And they put this thing together and off they went and got themselves into the parade by being a part of the vintage car group right at the end of it. And they had great fun. And they actually got recognised by the local press, and I think they got the only picture I ever saw in the paper of the function was this little car of theirs, this quad cycle. It lasted a long time. They used to go all around Upper Hutt together. This from a quad cycle got well known.
Cool.
But it was a good thing. It was a good thing for them in the constructing of it, because it took a lot of time to do it, and it kept them very involved. But it was constructive fun they were having. It was like the first car Paul wanted. He wanted a car, and he'd learnt to drive, and so forth. And got his driving license, that was all right, it's provincial. But I said, well, I've got a lot of money here for your cars. And he said, oh, I've got a few, Bob. And he managed to buy a car, I forget what, I think he got it for about $20 or something. It was an old Morris. It was a really clapped out thing. The clutch was useless. How we got it home, we drove it home, you got it into gear and got it going, and just had to go very slowly along, you see, and then just throw it into neutral when you wanted to stop, you see. Anyway, we got this thing home, and I said, all right, well, now we've got a lot of work to do on it, so I'm going to help you with the job. And I literally helped him strip it right down, and we got it right down, the engine's right out. You could open the boot and look right through where the radiator was, you know. In other words, it was completely gutted. It was in our garage, all labelled and stuff. And so I said, well, right, there it is. Now your job is to rebuild it. And I then stepped back, and he then put it back together again, including making a multi-cable. I don't know what a multi-cable was, but in those days you had a lot of wires that went down from the steering wheel, which controlled all your radiator, your lights, not your radiator, your indicators, your lights and things like that, you see. This is known as a multi-cable. So he had to make a brand new one of these and lean it, you know, line it all up. But he worked his way through it and got it. I think the only thing I really helped him with, that he needed help, was with the gearbox and the clutch. Yeah, those are the two things that I had to take away and get professionally done. But otherwise, he put all new rings in it and so forth. And then rebuilt the whole thing up, yeah. Put it back together. And so really, when he finished, he knew a lot about motor cars. There's no getting away from that. And he could service his own car after that one. So there was a little bit of sense in my madness of helping him tear it to pieces so that he couldn't use it now until he got it built up again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, couldn't do it.
Do you remember any of the floods?
The year of the flood? Oh, yes. That's right. Because they hadn't done the stop banks or anything like that. The river used to come very close to our house. It was at the bottom of there. We were raised, then we went down to our vegetable garden, and then over the fence line to this, what they call the stop bank, but it was only just a high mound going along, which finished about another 20 or 30 yards south of us. It finished. And then you went over that, and there was the river on the other side. Well, the flood did, the only time we ever saw it became dangerous, where we can come over. And it didn't actually come over the bank. It came round the end of the bank and built back between the bank and the sections, you see. It came up that little gullyway. And it came into my vegetable garden, which was the lower part. It only came in, so we had about 6 or 10 inches of water in there, I suppose, that was all. It just seeped in, and then it seeped out again with the tide. So we didn't get flooded from the house, but our section got it all right.
Did you know other people who were worst affected?
Not directly affected, no, not personally, no. There were some down the road, but we didn't know them personally. None of our neighbours were, not the immediate neighbourhood anyway. But it certainly was some mighty river running at that time. It certainly shaped things, but it also moved things along, because very shortly afterwards they started the development of a stop bank, which is actually the road today. Because they built the road along the top of the stop bank.
Right.
And then the river was pushed further towards the hills. So at one time, the river was very close to us. Now the kids have to walk some couple of hundred yards before you get to the river, taking all the fun out of it. So they used to have a lot of fun down there. In fact, we even caught a trout right at the end of our garden. It was in a pool there. That was in a drought situation, though. It was caught in a puddle. Didn't last long in the puddle.
No. What about swimming?
Swimming, yes. I didn't swim a lot in the river. The kids used to go down and swim. And it was as safe as water could be, really. I mean, it didn't go more than knee high. It's very safe for them to poddle around in. You'd get one or two little pools falling, which might get waist high to a child. But they're only small pools. And they weren't up against the upper hut side. They were more on the other side of the river. They used to swing across. They used to have nicknames for a lot of the places. They used to have nicknames for these pools, and McCurdy's Castle or something. There was a farmer over the way. He was known as the matchstick farmer, matchbox farmer, because he used to burn scrub. You used to time it very nicely for a Monday morning when all the women had got their washing on the line, and suddenly you see a belch of smoke coming up from the other side of the river, and McCurdy burning some more gorse down or something like that. You see. Well, she was allowed to do it, he had permission for it, and it never, the fire's never gone away on him or anything like that, but he just burnt in little sections. But it was just annoying enough for the wind to be coming towards the houses rather than the other way.
So they were still farming there at that time?
They were, all the farming, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a small, they were farming, but they were, how can I put it? There were scrub farms, you know, the cattle all were lost in amongst all the bushes and stuff like that. There was there weren't paddocks or anything like that. Not that you and I know of.
Oh, yeah.
But they, there were certainly were.
But was McCurdy's castle empty by that stage?
Yes, it was an old house that was used by him, and that's why they called it the McCurdy's castle or something like that. They used to go out and have a look at it and peek through the windows and things like that, but that was all. It was a dear thing to go up to it.
Have you been there?
No, never, sorry.
Pardon? The kids went there, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Not a lot of times, but they have talked about it. But it was a thing that was talked about and looked at from a distance more than anything else, because there's too many tales about it if you got too close, you see. Amongst children, you know, being haunted and all these sort of things were going on.
Yeah.
Because that's... Did you... Jean?
No.
Yes, because our daughter's husband, she met him. He was working on a farm on the hills, on the other side. So, yeah, that's right. So, but that was the only farm I knew of over there.
Mm.
Yeah. What else have we got about Upper Hutt?
Yeah, because we've got through most of my questions, really.
Mm.
So, is there anything else that you can think of?
Not that I
can. That we haven't covered?
I don't think so. We talked about the good times. No, I don't think so. You'll no doubt go and something else will pop to mind.
Always does.
Really, we should be looking at some, albums and things. But they are things that bring back memories.
Yeah, I should have brought some photos, actually.
Oh, I won a boat in Upper Hutt, that's right. That was my first boat. I always wanted a boat. And it was a Friday night, usual Friday night shopping, you see. I've got loads of stuff in my hands, and Gina's doing something. I had Paul, I think it was Elise, was with me. And I heard somebody yell out, "Here you are, I've got to buy a ticket here for the boat," you see, blah, blah. And I looked up, and it's one of my lodge friends. He was also in Rotary, you see, and this is a Rotary project. And he called, "Ken, come across here, not a ticket, I've got to buy a book off him." He wouldn't, he's getting all ready. And I thought, oh my God. I think it was £10 for a book, you see, and I thought, and I think I only had about £15 in my pocket. It had no more, and that was it. Anyway, here's your book, you see. So I didn't turn around to him and say, "I can't afford that." I just took this £10 note out, you see, gave it to him, and we get this book of tickets. And I thought no more about it. It must have been about a month later, we get a phone call, very excited woman, we'd won this dinghy. It was a ply-like dinghy in the oars and things, brand new, on a trailer and so forth. We'd won the dinghy. Well, I'm made. I'd got my boat. And we had a lot of fun taking this out down to Plymouth and things like this, just rowing it round. But I wanted one with a motor in it, because I'm used to my friends up in Taupo, they've all got big boats and motors and things, so I wanted one with a motor. But Jean was saying to me, "Oh no, look at the kids. If you had a motor on that, would you see those kids having that fun? Because they wouldn't be able to operate the motor, but they had the oars, they could do that." So we had this thing without any motor on for about a year, and we took it to Taupo on holiday one, meet our friends up there. And I was loaned a little seagull outboard to put on this thing so we could go out fishing on it. So anyway, I just thought I must upgrade. So I managed to sell that. Well, I saw a boat I would like to buy, sold the dinghy, which gave me enough money to buy the new boat. I think I might have to put a couple of dollars to it or something. So we then buy the next one up, which was a bit bigger, and it had a motor on it. It had a 35 horsepower Evinrude or something. But it was really the fact that it was a boat with a motor, and I bought it, but it was a real run-down boat. When I got it home and looked at the thing, I had to scrub it right down and not rebuild it, but it all had to be repainted, and there's some repair work to be done on it and so forth. And we got it going. And so the next time up to Taupo with my friends, I'm now towing a decent size 14-foot boat with a motor on it, an Evinrude on the back. And of course they looked at it and said, "Come on, that's a flat bottom boat, you're going to have some fun in that thing," you see. So I realised then that it wasn't an ideal boat for Taupo. Being a flat bottom, it's all right when you've got no waves, but as soon as you've got waves, you're useless, you see. However, we had a good run with this darn thing. We had two runs to Taupo, 2 years. And then when I went to Taupo, I then found, with one of the local manufacturers, a new 16-foot-6, what they call a clinker boat. That doesn't mean a thing to you. It's a ply-like boat, but it's built like like planks, you know. And instead of having frames going across, it has actually like a skeleton. It's made, it's like a rib cage. And then it's all copper riveted on the boat. So it's a very strong boat, you see. And this is a part, what do you call it, a day boat. You know, it had a high windscreen and so forth, but you could go in out into a little forward cabin, you know, which open to get into it, but you could get shelter. But I could stand up at the back there with a great big screen, and you know, the way you went, and this boat really motored, you see. It was built for Taupo. So we progressed to that, and I then put a bigger motor on it, and we built up. We had everything on this boat that you could imagine. You know, radio,
but
lights.
It all started from a boat you
it
won.
It all started and I bought from what I bought, and I ended up with an ideal setup. It was beautiful. Even Jean was proud to be on this one. Yeah. In fact, I confess, I'm sure I looked after that boat better than I looked after Jean.
Oh,
how's that?
Surely not.
It was. You didn't go on that boat with shoes on. You took your shoes off. You had your bare feet. It had mahogany deck all around.
Lovely.
Oh, it was beautiful. Fantastic. Carpet. It was called Jean.
We might be just about done here.
Right.
Do you think?
Yep, that's good.
It's about
tea time, isn't it?
Fantastic. Must be.